Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. This week saw another mass shooting, this time at a Washington naval facility where 12 people were killed. There was another mass shooting in Chicago last night. Congress is threatening a government showdown over Obamacare. In international news, the United Nations issued a report confirming Syria's use of chemical weapons, though the findings are being disputed. Russia criticized the report as biased and incomplete. Negotiations over how to deal with Syria, where millions have fled civil war, continue in the Security Council, which is trying to draft a resolution of action. We're going to talk about that with our guests, William Arkin, author of American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution, and Fred Weir, who reports for the Christian Science Monitor from Russia, where he's joining us. Hi, William.
How are you today?
Hi, Fred.
Hi.
We've got both of you on. We always start the Friday Roundtable with kudos to reporting that you saw or heard this week that you thought was especially good. Anybody want to start us off?
Well, as a journalist in Washington.
Oh wait, let's go with William.
Okay.
As a journalist who covers Washington, I tend to very selectively read the press. So I'm looking at people who write things because I know that they consistently say things that I don't already know. So I tend to look at what Jeremy Scahill is writing, Eric Schmidt in the New York Times, Greg Miller in the Washington Post. What's on Steve Aftergood's internet site, Secrecy News? What's at Cryptome, which is another internet website? So you know what? I have to tell you, that's really where I spend most of my time. I want to know what the competitors are writing and what the good reporters are writing.
And is there anything in particular that you saw this week that you'd like to give a shout-out to, William?
Well, I've read a lot about the Washington Navy Yard shooting, and I have to say the reporting that has really impressed me the most has been in the National Journal. It just seems to me that beyond the local story and the story of the victims of this unfortunate incident, the National Journal is really trying to get to the question of why so little has changed since Snowden on contractors and why so little has changed on security clearances, even though we've faced this sort of problem in the past.
Yeah, and I think it was in the New York Times this morning that was reporting that Alexis and Snowden were cleared by the same firm, by the same security firm.
Well, that doesn't particularly surprise me because in the world of contractors, there's essentially one major firm that has gotten the contract from the Office of Personnel Management to do most of these background investigations. It's not the firm's problem. It's the criteria that they're applying in order to give clearances to people to work for the government or work for contractors. If something derogative is turned up in theory, it's supposed to go to a higher level for adjudication. But clearly in this case and in so many other cases, it doesn't happen. And I think one of the reasons is because we so much increasingly are dependent upon private companies and private contractors in order to do all of the basic work of government.
Yeah, and we'll talk a lot more about that. That's a lot of what is in your book is the growth of this national security state. But I think for people like me who are not immersed in it, it is shocking every time we hear about how large this is. Let's turn to Fred, who is with us from Russia. Any shout-outs that you want to give to particularly great reporting that you saw this week, Fred?
Well, not so much about reporting, but a media event, and that is these dueling op-eds between Putin, who wrote in the New York Times last week, and John McCain, who stepped up and published his own column about what's wrong with Russia and how to fix it in a Russian online newspaper yesterday. And especially on the Russian side, this is something of a novelty, you know, and I think it's got possibilities to expand. You know, when you go to this Russian website, it's called Pravda.ru, you see that it has attracted literally hundreds and hundreds of comments, because unlike the gray lady, the Pravda.ru does permit comments under this story, and there is just an amazing variety of, and some of them are quite insightful.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the comments?
A lot of the comments are are picking apart his John McCain's attitude toward Russia, which is kind of Cold War-ish, to put it in a nutshell. Finding what's wrong with it, that it's he's right on this, he's wrong on that. There's really quite a lot of intelligent analysis among the comments, as well as the usual, stupid or single-minded responses that you do find in these things. But there's just no doubt that there is a huge variety of Russian response, like just from the Vox Populi and the comment section, which I spent like several hours reading yesterday, just because, some of them you can scroll right through, but some of them you have to stop and realize that there's some Russian out there who's read McCain's column, thought about it, and issued a response. In some of the cases, the columns, the response is as long as the original column itself.
And is there a lot of precedent for that in Russian media? Is this something that's different than the status quo, or is this common in Russian media?
This is new. This is a fairly new thing. It has happened before in kind of set piece ways, but the spontaneous nature of it, the fact that Putin published his op-ed in the New York Times, and I realize it's not so novel in the United States. And John McCain felt that he needed to respond, to take up the gauntlet. And he wrote his own very trenchant anti-Putin piece. That's new for Russia. That's new, and it clearly kind of caught the public and they're going with it.
Yeah, it seems like geopolitics is catching everybody off guard this last month. So tell us how the Syrian civil war and the whole standoff between the U.S. and Russia over it is being covered in the Russian press, Fred.
Well, the Russian press, by and large, takes the viewpoint of the Russian government. Even analysts and experts here in Russia, who can be at odds with the Kremlin over a lot of things, particularly domestic things, tend to support the Russian government's Syria and not just its Syria policy, but its broader approach to the Middle East. It does seem to be rooted in Russian attitudes, and it's not just Putin who has got this. This policy that supports Assad, it does seem to have a broader geopolitical resonance, and most Russian experts have this view too.
And William, just asking you from Washington, how was Putin's piece in the New York Times covered and viewed from there?
I'm not physically in Washington. That's the nature of the world today. I actually live in Vermont, but it seems to me that whatever happens that doesn't comport with the way that people in Washington want the world to work is the way in which they then therefore criticize. So even though I think everybody is quite happy with the fact that that bombs are not dropping on Syria right now, it's amazing to me to see how the wonks are out in full force, essentially making an argument that what was tried diplomatically with Iraq from 1991 until the second Iraq war in 2003 is going to be repeated in Syria, almost as if they are rooting for military action instead, which it seems to me to be the height of cynicism right now.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see how that this has been portrayed in media, particularly by pundits and analysts, that somehow not taking military action in Syria made Obama weak, made Putin sort of be taking the lead, and it was almost like a, let me use the phrase, a shouting match where Putin won. How are you both viewing this and seeing the coverage, and where is the coverage of this deeper and the analysis where we should be looking? The sort of Putin-Obama smackdown.
Who are you asking?
Either of you.
Well, from my perspective, you know, with the arms control oriented press seems to be rooting for this kind of a disarmament arms control outcome. The mainstream media seems to be obsessed with itself and thereby an op-ed that appeared in its own papers and what it means. There's a lot of scorekeeping on Obama because somehow not using military force seems to be either a failure or now I think increasingly you see little whispers of it maybe being a brilliant move on Obama's part, who was unhappy with or uncomfortable with whatever military options he was presented with. I don't think we've read the last thing about Syria, and certainly the situation inside the country, other than the issue of WMD, hasn't changed one iota yet. Our level of crisis has diminished considerably. So I think if I were a listener and I were thinking about what media to pay attention to as I move forward, I would look for stories that don't say that weapons of mass destruction are more important than any other human issue that we might be facing. And that might help you to understand why it is that Washington sometimes gets revved up about certain things and doesn't get revved up about others.
Anything that you want to add to that, Fred? And then I think I'll move to the national security state. So go ahead.
Okay, well, I've been covering this from Russia for the last couple of years, and this is one thing that Russia has been consistent on. I know in the United States there has been, you know, quite a lot of swinging back and forth about the Arab Spring, and in Egypt, I just have no idea actually what U.S. policy is right now over the events that have gone back and forth there. But Russia has been consistent. They have supported Assad, partly because the Assad regime, father and son, have been Russian clients for the last 40 years, partly because they regard that as the legitimate government. But also partly because Russia is a country that's had its own revolutionary history with which they are very disappointed now, and therefore they take a dim view of all revolutionary enthusiasm. It's kind of, Russia is in this sense, a very conservative society. And the leadership, all the more so because they do not have a democratic mandate, and therefore they feel themselves vulnerable to the same kind of, you know, upsurge from the street, and particularly vulnerable to this idea of foreign intervention, of humanitarian wars that step in and move the needle one way or the other, which is what the United States and Britain and France are strong advocates of. It's not that Russia or that Putin necessarily fears that that the West will intervene in Russia one day when the people may be rioting in the streets of Moscow, but he hates that precedent. And also because Russia is a faded superpower, they're very keenly aware of their lack of real, the kind of muscle the Soviet Union used to have. They put all this stress on the UN Security Council, on sovereignty of nations, and this help is kind of necessary to understand this, to understand why Russia has been so stubborn over these past 2 years and completely consistent in blocking any effort to get one of those Chapter 7 resolutions that advocate that authorize the use of force in Syria in any context, and they will continue to be. On the other hand, they do see the possibility of a diplomatic solution there. They, unlike the former Soviet Union, they're not antagonistic, completely antagonistic to the West. They could work together, and I think this current project, if it gets off the ground and goes, where Russia and the U.S. will play the key role in pushing it forward to disarm Assad of his chemical weapons, this could change the whole outlook for world diplomacy, if it works.
For U.S.-Russian relations as well. So what do you think is the end game for Russia in Syria? Do they want Assad to stay?
What they want is some semblance of that regime to remain, not just because it's their former client, but because they have all these fears I spoke of. And what they may not love Assad as a, because or think he's a Democrat or anything like that, but they are deeply suspicious of these democratic enthusiasms that the West is fond of, and they have what can only be described as a phobia about militant Islamism. And where maybe John Kerry looks at the Syrian opposition and sees the glass more than half full, the moderates are dominating, the Russians see al-Qaeda everywhere. They see their own militants from the North Caucasus, from Chechnya, fighting down there, gaining experience. They fear the collapse of central government in Syria. And central government means the Assad regime. So their end game would be some kind of negotiated solution which would get the moderate Syrian opposition to come to terms with the Assad regime. Maybe it would transform the nature of Syria, like maybe there'd be autonomy for the Kurds or something like this, and more a transitional government with more opposition people in it. But it would have to remain secular. This is the main thing with the Russians. And it would have to squeeze out the militant Islamists.
And,
absolutely adamant about.
The Associated Press today is reporting that al-Qaeda militants seized a town in Syria near the Turkish border on Thursday after expelling rebels from the area. And it says that there's a growing power of jihadists as they seek to expand their influence in the opposition-held Syrian territory. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're speaking with Fred Weir, who reports for the Christian Science Monitor from Russia, and William Arkin, who's the author of American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. And if you'd like to join our conversation about media coverage this week, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Where are you seeing the best coverage of the Syrian civil war, of the NSA and the Snowden leaks? What stories stood out for you this week? What do you think was covered especially well? And what do you think is missing more coverage? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. You can also ask William Arkin anything that you want about the growth of the national security state. And speaking of that, William, this week Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff postponed a planned state visit to the U.S. to protest NSA spying on her, on her government, and other Latin Americans. Can you kind of recap what happened for our listeners?
Well, I think that we need to understand the context of the entire episode and what really is happening here. There are a lot of governments all around the world that are shocked that there's gambling going on in the casino. you know, that's sort of the public stance associated with this. You know, we live in this globalized, information-rich world. And the fact that the NSA or the United States, more importantly, is spying on Brazil or other countries behind their backs, Germany, of course, being one of the major ones that has become exercised about this, shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. But I think the debate hasn't quite caught up with the information technology. And so whether it's Brazil or the United States, where NSA seems to be on everybody's lips, as do drones and license plate readers and all of the devices of modern policing and intelligence and surveillance that seem to be hitting the U.S. as well, there's a general anxiety that perhaps what happened after 9/11 in terms of the growth of surveillance is something that has now become ubiquitous and worldwide, and we really just haven't caught up with it in terms of thinking through the social, political, even legal implications.
And you say that the U.S. is a nation living under two sets of laws. One is public, as guided by the Constitution, and then there's this kind of invisible text that exists in between the lines, this duality that you say is codified through decades of concealing this kind of second national security state called the program. Explain that to us.
Well, so I wrote this book called American Coup, and I called it American Coup specifically because I wanted to specify what was uniquely American about this coup. It's not military officers taking over, as we might see in Latin America or elsewhere in the world. This is a wholly civilian takeover, but it's a takeover by a very small group of civilians who are associated with the national security establishment. And it's not just the takeover that has occurred, it's a change in a way of thinking, so that even the most liberal president of our lifetime, Barack Obama, not only comes into office and continues many of the national security practices of his predecessors, but now, even after a term and a half, continues to justify certain things like NSA surveillance or the killing drone campaign as being, quote, legal and U.S. policy and in our interests. And it's that assertion of legality and policy written in Washington and then affirmed by Washington that is what I call the XYZ of U.S. governance, which is to say that there is this sort of bubble around the national security establishment in Washington, and it's one that wields an enormous amount of influence both across the country and across the world.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. Fred, I was wondering, related to this NSA, where is Edward Snowden now, and how is his case and his status being covered in Russian media?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to the first part of your question. Nobody does. He was whisked away. He is apparently with American friends here in Moscow somewhere. And, of course, we've all put our busy minds to work wondering who these American friends could be, because it's a fairly limited expat community here, you know. But there are lots of political exiles, even from Soviet times. People wash up in a place like Moscow. They go to work for, like, the Voice of Russia or Russia Today. So there are lots of candidates for the Americans who may be helping him adjust to life here in Moscow. But he certainly has not shown up. Occasionally, his lawyer talks to Russian media. He does not talk to us, and says he's doing fine. He's even traveling incognito around Russia, studying Russian. His father and his father's lawyer, and maybe even his mother, are meant to visit sometime soon, and perhaps then we'll get something. Ever since he came out of the airport, he has simply disappeared.
And obviously, you as an American journalist are trying to find out where he is. Are Russians equally interested?
And we do get the occasional story in Russian newspapers that suggest that Russian journalists may have gotten close to him or to his circle. For instance, there was a story in Kommersant, which is a very big, respectable newspaper here in Moscow, a couple of weeks ago, which said...
Hey, Fred, we're coming up on a break. I'm going to have you tell us about this story right after we do the break. You're listening to the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Hey, studio, can you hear me? Bill Ark.
All the stories you hear on the Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks again to everyone who helped with the September membership campaign. Over 2,500 listeners joined during the campaign, over 450 new members, again from all of us here at Local Public Radio. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we're going to have a conversation about the Gates Foundation. It's one of the largest and wealthiest philanthropic organizations in the country, and it's spending millions of dollars on education-related programs. So what are they trying to do with education reform globally and domestically? What do you want to know about the Gates Foundation and their education reform agenda? That'll be Monday on Your Call. Tuesday, we'll ask, who owns San Francisco? We're going to be talking about the history of San Francisco's movers and shakers and ask, who really has power in this city? What forces are at play? And how is the city changing? Today, of course, is our media roundtable. We're discussing Syria, the debate over how to deal with chemical weapons, geopolitical relations between the U.S. and Russia, and the rise of the national security state in the United States. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined by Fred Weir, who reports for the Christian Science Monitor from Russia, and William Arkin, who's the author of American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. You can join our conversation and ask any questions you have about the national security state and its growth. 866-798-TALK is the toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Give a shout-out to good reporting that you saw this week, or tell us what you want covered more. You can also speak with William Arkin, who did write all about the national security state and its growth. The number is 866-798-8255. And we just have a couple more minutes with Fred Weir. Sorry I cut you off there. We had a break I needed to go to. You were telling us about how the mystery of Snowden, Edward Snowden, is being covered by Russian media. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, one of the biggest question marks about the whole Snowden story, how he washed up in the Moscow airport and remained there for 38 days, is what role did Russia play? He went to Hong Kong. Then, after his passport, his U.S. passport was canceled, he did manage to get on an Aeroflot airliner to Moscow. And Putin had said many times, didn't know about it, didn't know until 2 hours before the plane landed that Snowden was aboard it. And yet, this Russian newspaper, and it is a big, respectable newspaper that seldom, you know, publishes this information, did an investigative piece in which they found that Snowden had actually spent at least 2 days in the Russian consulate in Hong Kong before he got on that plane and came to Moscow. So that raises a lot of questions about whether or not Russia or some Russian agencies did help Snowden get here. And also, the Kommersant story said that Cuba refused him entry, and that would explain why he did not get onto his connecting flight the next day to Havana. But, you know, that we just had that. It dropped, and we do not have any follow-up, and we can't talk to Snowden. So all this remains, you know, up in the air and a matter of intense interest to us all.
And are you able to speak with Russian officials pretty easily? Is it is Putin ever accessible?
Putin is accessible in particular things. He loves to give marathon press conferences, for example, and we get to get up and ask our question in those places. Most of Russian officialdom is not easy to get to. And about this subject, about Snowden, not at all. Even his lawyer will not return our calls. He talks to the Russian media sometimes, but never to us.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Fred Weir is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He reports from Russia. We have links to all of his articles at yourcallradio.org. Thank you, Fred. And we have a full bank of callers. Let's go to callers. Max, welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. Thank you for a very informative program, as usual. I thank you. I have two comments, really two questions. The first, in line with what Mr. Weir just said, in the French press, there's been some speculation that from the get-go, this whole Snowden affair has been under the control of Russia's security services. And one writer pointed to the fact that Mr. Snowden had the opportunity to go from Hawaii directly to through Mexico to Latin America, Venezuela or Ecuador, where he would have found refuge. That this whole thing through Hong Kong just does not add up. That's one thing that was raised in the French press. But there was also a success story discussed today in the French-based magazine called Jeune Afrique. It was about the inauguration of the new president of Mali, Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, who won a presidential election, transparent and fair, following a military intervention by the French army that dislodged the Islamists from Mali. That's a success story from their perspective. And, of course, the country faces enormous problems. And let's hope that the success will continue. I'll stop here and thank you for a good program.
So, Max, is your question whether Snowden affair is under the control of the Russian security forces from the beginning?
Well, that is the speculation in the French media. And there were a few articles, very short articles, in line with what you guessed said a little earlier, that there is a conviction in some quarters that's what happened.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you so much, Max. Appreciate the call. Let's get a response from William Arkin.
Thank you, Holly. But first, I should say I only heard about a half of Max's question. Apologies to him because I'm not getting in the telephone very clearly, so you might want to have your engineers look at that.
We will do it. Essentially, he was saying that the French press is reporting that the Snowden affair has entirely been controlled by the Russian security services, that Snowden had the opportunity to go straight from Hawaii to Latin America, and that didn't happen. I don't know if this is just all speculation, but if you wanted to respond to that. Otherwise, we have plenty of other callers we can go to.
Well, let me just say that from what I have heard and what I do understand, okay, first I would like to just say that Snowden is not the totality of the story, and everyone who's writing about Snowden from the point of view of a reporter is writing about Snowden because they are not able to write about NSA, which is to say they're not able to get the story of what the other 18,000 people who work at this agency are doing. So I feel like we sort of trivialize the issues underlying what Snowden has revealed by speculating and spending so much time and energy on him and on conspiracy theories surrounding him. It seems to me he was a genuine person who got a job surreptitiously in order to surreptitiously steal documents, which he did. And I'm grateful that I know all that information, but I don't think he's the story.
And so, William, you've written a lot about what you do think is the story. I should say that you're a former intelligence officer yourself. When you write the title of your book, again, it's William Arkin's book, American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. What do you mean by a terrified government?
Well, it seems like since 9/11, we've been living under a system and a rule of fear, whether it be a fear of Al-Qaeda perpetrating another 9/11 attack, a fear of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, a fear of the Taliban, a fear of terrorism in general, now a fear of homegrown terrorism and anything that might disrupt the American civil infrastructure and what's called the critical infrastructure, that this emergency that began after 9/11, one that might have been quite understandable, is now in its 13th year. And we don't seem to be anywhere closer to either concluding our quest against terrorism or making the United States any safer so that we can somehow loosen the reins of government control and national security. So to me, the one of the prime reasons is fear, and it's fear on the part of those in Washington that they, in fact, have a sense of what the threats are to the United States and what needs to be done in response to them, and fear on the part of the American public that they've accepted that, indeed, our security is dependent upon all of these measures by the federal government, and that we need to sacrifice some of our freedoms, or at least we need to weigh our programs more towards national security than towards other needs because the threat demands that.
And what do you think are legitimate fears and what is unfounded or overblown?
Well, again, when I see a Washington Navy Yard shooting or I see a Boston Marathon bombing, I'm always curious that the first reaction is, more security clearances, more national identification, more biometrics, more surveillance, more from the very government entities that failed in the first place to detect and stop these incidents. So that worries me because it seems that there's a kind of a cycle that doesn't really include accountability for those that might be responsible for mistakes made, especially when we learn again and again and again that some part of the government had information relating to the people who perpetrated these crimes, and that information wasn't conveyed, wasn't seriously looked at, wasn't taken seriously. And so I think that we need to step one step back ourselves in our society and ask ourselves whether or not we've held government and particularly the security people accountable enough in order for us to weigh whether or not we're doing the right thing.
And let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to your call.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the program. What I'm wondering about is the connection between and the influence between the NSA and private corporations, which are contracting. It seems that I know that there have been connections before, but with Dick Cheney and his involvement with private contractors for pre-Iraq and Iraq, it just seems that you could have almost like J. Edgar Hoover on steroids within the private sector. Any comments on the connections?
Okay, let's. Thank you, Bill. William, were you able to hear that? Bill asks.
No, I'm sorry, I wasn't.
Let me repeat it for you. Bill asks about the connection between the NSA and the private companies that are contracting with that agency to perform these security services, and he talks about the remarkable growth of this private sector. He seems to say that it's really goes back to Cheney, Vice President Cheney. But can you talk about that growth of these private security corporations?
Well, I worked on the Top Secret America project with Dana Priest at the Washington Post, and we did a long series on the growth of contracting in 2010 in the newspaper. I think that the facts seem to clearly show that the growth of government contracting began under the Clinton administration. It was a way in which government could grow without growing. So, in other words, you could do things without increasing the number of people who were in government ranks and thereby announce that you're not making the government any larger. And second, you could do things under emergency appropriations with pockets of money that weren't really accounted for in the same way that the normal budget was accounted for. And in the intelligence world, that was a particularly important feature of the Clinton administration's beginning of its war against terrorism. So the growth of contracting certainly has ballooned since 9/11, and it has certainly become, I think, a crisis point for America. But it's not a Cheney invention. And in the case of NSA, I think that when we look at it, we have to understand that part of the reason why the government relies so much on the private sector is that the nature of information and information technology is changing so quickly. And the danger, of course, on the one hand, is you have to rely upon the experts who exist in the private sector who can move and who can are able to shift much quicker than the government itself is able to shift and move. But on the other hand, they're not accountable in the same way that that people who work for the government or the government itself is. They're interested in making profits for their companies. And I think that one of the implications of that is that very few in the contracting world are going to stand up and say, you know, whatever it is that we're being asked to do on behalf of the government really is unnecessary or redundant or ridiculous. ridiculous or illegal, because in the end it's another contract, it's another pot of money, and certainly there's very little that the Obama administration has done substantially to change that. There's been a lot of nice talk about reducing contractors, reducing headquarters, reducing the power of Washington, but there really hasn't been much substance behind that talk.
Wait, you seem to be saying that somebody in a private company who's doing this security work would be less likely to blow the whistle on something that they thought was unconstitutional, for example, than somebody in the military?
Well, somebody in the military or an employee of the government. I mean, since 9/11, as an example, we've certainly seen more people come out of the State Department or the NSA itself speaking about what they thought were the illegalities or waste and abuse being perpetrated by the NSA than Snowden. So it's probably
a ratio
of about 10 to 1.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're speaking with William Arkin. He's the author of American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. It's about the growth of the national security state in the United States. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Is there anything that you want to understand about how the NSA works, how it's grown since the Eisenhower administration, and particularly under the Clinton and Bush and Obama administrations? Our number is 866-798-8255. And let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to your call.
Thank you, Rose. 2 points for William Arkin. The first one is, given their function as the means by which we determine who and where are our enemies, isn't it axiomatic that if the intelligence agency scoops up information on everyone, that it means they don't know who the enemy is? And the other point is, what gives us the expectation that the president or the office of the president isn't blunted in its initiatives by the same mechanism? What makes us think, in other words, that the presidency is immune to this spying? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, George. William, did you catch George's question or comment?
I did, yes.
Great. Can you respond?
So to me, I think that the absence of an enemy is really half of the story. The difference of the NSA story today than, say, in the 1960s when the government was spying on the anti-war movement and spying on communists and the civil rights movement is that today there isn't an enemies list in the same way. Today, it's really all about collecting as much information as possible and finding the needle in the haystack when you don't even know if there's a needle and you don't know where it is. So I do agree with the caller that we are in this sort of different realm today in which we are, I guess you would call it post-enemy, in the sense that anyone is potentially an enemy, while at the same time no one is actually an enemy because those who are the actual enemies, well, they're legally being surveilled by the FBI or by those who can go before the courts and say have a predicate in which to investigate this person. On the question of whether the NSA spies on the White House or somehow exerts some kind of influence that's separate from the U.S. government, I think that this has always been a kind of fear and also a fantasy of people on the outside. You know, as somebody on the inside, when we say NSA, it seems to me that you got to remember that we're saying the U.S. government. The U.S. government tells the NSA what it wants it to collect. And the people who are on top at the NSA, the people who are in charge at the NSA, are appointed by the government. So there's not really very much daylight between what the NSA does and what the Obama administration wants. And we've seen again and again and again, whether it's in targeted killing or in these various NSA exposés, and this is not the first one that we've seen in the Obama administration, that the White House fully supports what it is that the NSA has done. It claims that it fully reviewed it. It claims that it's totally legal. So I don't see daylight between the NSA and the U.S. government. I think that the NSA is not an agency out of control. I think that the U.S. government tells the NSA, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the other national security agencies, what they want to collect and what they want to know. The problem is that when you're dealing with information, as opposed to be dealing with a specific enemy or an industrial enemy, which is to say where you can count tanks and you can count missiles and you can count bombers and you have a sense of what the balance is. When you're dealing with information, it's unlimited. And so we in a society have to place the limits upon the U.S. government as to what it can collect, because we're in completely new territory here. Of course the U.S. government thinks it needs to collect everything, because where does information end? And that's the question that I think we're now facing for the first time in our era as a result of the Snowden leaks.
And let's go to another caller. Ken in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hey, good morning. I'm just amazed, from the Mark Klein revelations, the AT&T technician who found all the internet and phone traffic split off right here in San Francisco for the whole half of the United States or Western Seaboard. That was apologized. Those companies were forgiven. It was marked as, this one-time thing when we were really desperate. But it's amazing to me that both Republicans or Democrats, despite, different politics, they seem to do the same thing when it comes to military and the NSA. I'm just kind of aghast that, Nancy Pelosi et al., Obama, think, that's what we need to do. Don't question it. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. Is there a big dividing line at all here? Where does this cut across political lines or ideological lines, William?
No, I think it does. It cuts across all lines, at least since 9/11. I see a few voices in the Congress and a few voices in the country politically who are absolute about too much government surveillance or too much government freedom in this field. But by and large, no, I don't see much of a difference between Pelosi and Obama, which is to say I don't see much of a difference between Pelosi, Obama, and Cheney on this subject. And that's should be troublesome to all Americans. You know, San Francisco does play a special role in this story, and we forgot that. So I'm really thankful to the caller for pointing it out. You know, here was...
Yeah, go ahead.
A leaker who said, I have information that, the telecommunications industry is cooperating with the U.S. government to essentially give it batch access to everything. And the guy wasn't taken seriously enough until the Snowden came along and the actual documents that seemed to confirm that are put right into our face. So we've kind of known this for a long time, but I think, again, our biggest problem in American society is that we don't really understand the way information moves. We don't really understand what the impact of globalization has been on the movement of information. And as a result of that, our legislation, our political discussion, our reporting, our cultural understanding of the new era of privacy and information has fallen way behind what the reality of what the government can do is.
Let me try and sneak in one more call, William. Stephen in San Francisco, can you please be really brief? We're running out of time.
Yeah, this is really difficult, and I just wanted to say thank you for the program. The corporate personhoods established by the Supreme Court, the corporate lobbyists basically have the ear of the NSA and Cheney's group and the Rand Corp and the McDonnell Douglas. You know, they're armed to the teeth, and now with corporate personhood, they have the right to be armed to the teeth as a so-called American citizen. But with basically the security apparatus monitoring everything, what hope do we have that CO2 will ever, those emissions will ever be curtailed, because those corporations have a vested interest in continuing to emit CO2 emissions?
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Let's just get final thoughts. William, you've got about a minute left. Anything that you really want to make sure that our audience is thinking about?
Well, it seems to me that everybody is thinking about the same thing, which is how to curtail the power of Washington and how to bring under control an apparatus which grew, ballooned out of control after 9/11 and now continues to persist. I think we just need to ask ourselves whether or not we really hold the government accountability for our accountable for our security, and second, whether the money that we put towards national security is well spent, or whether there shouldn't be money put towards other things. It's a really basic question. I don't think much has changed, but we live in such a different world today that we need to update many of our assumptions about both the nature of government and certainly the nature of information. That's why I wrote American Coup.
And the book is American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. The author is William Arkin. He is a former intelligence officer and an investigative journalist. Thank you for joining us, William.
Thanks for having me on your show today.
And we're going to have to leave it there, but we will put information to all of these articles, a link to American Coup, and information about it at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. You can always continue the conversation there by posting comments. You can also write us about what you think we should be covering. We've been speaking this hour with Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor. He's the correspondent in Russia, and William Arkin, who's an award-winning journalist and author of the new book, American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. Thanks to everybody who emailed and called us, and I apologize that we couldn't get to everything. Again, we'll put links at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What do you want to know about the Gates Foundation? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how Gates is influencing the ongoing debate about education reform. Since 2006, it has spent $472 million to remake U.S. higher education and poured billions of dollars into K-12 related programs. What are they trying to do with education reform globally and domestically? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, and I want to thank everyone who contributed to the station during our small but mighty September membership campaign. As the drive wrapped up, KALW listeners had contributed more than $292,000 to support local public radio. Now, that was short of our goal of $350,000, but given that we made a commitment to a shorter drive and the fact that we'd already extended it by a day, we decided to wind it down. Fortunately, thanks to the generous support of the community in recent years, KALW is in a good financial position. And in the coming weeks, I'm confident that people who care about and appreciate this station will help us close the gap. These campaigns are a really wonderful time to reinforce the connection this station has to this amazing community. Thank you for always being there with us, and here's to doing much more together.
This is KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello and welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Karen Giannone with The Global Conversation here on the BBC.
We cannot insist only on issues related to abortion, gay marriage, and the use of contraceptive methods. This is not possible. It is not necessary to talk about these issues all the time.
Well, he's already made an impact with his unconventional way of doing things. Now Pope Francis has sent shockwaves through the Roman Catholic Church. With his remarks, it's become obsessed with issues surrounding homosexuality and birth control. He's criticised the Church for putting dogma, in other words, its set of principles, before love. We're talking to Catholics from different perspectives, asking, is the church changing for the better? Share your thoughts with the programme on Twitter using the hashtag WHYS, or you can get in touch with us via our Facebook page.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says Syria has submitted a list of the country's chemical stockpiles. Syria is believed to have around 1,000 tonnes of chemical toxins. Paul Adams reports.
The Russians and Americans get...
Syria is believed to have around 1,000 tonnes of chemical toxins.
If Syria...